From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, we continue our look at presidential politics and consider the impact of the Nixon presidency with Rick Perlstein, author of Nixonland, The Rise of a President and the Fracturing of America. He says Nixon collected resentments growing up and had an intuitive talent for playing on the fears and anxieties of middle-class Americans to his political advantage. Also, director Brett Morgan tells us about the Chicago 8 conspiracy trial, which arose from events at the 1968 Democratic Convention. The trial's recreated in Morgan's documentary, which combines archival footage and animation. And film critic John Powers remembers film critic and artist Manny Farber, who died Monday at the age of 91. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. Today we complete our series on presidents and presidential politics. We begin with historian Rick Perlstein, whose book Nixonland, The Rise of a President and the Fracturing of America, was published earlier this year. Perlstein's book is an evocative trip through the 60s and early 70s, and an assessment of the impact of Richard Nixon's political career. Perlstein argues that many of the deep divisions of modern American politics were drawn in that period and effectively exploited by Nixon. Perlstein's previous book was Before the Storm, Barry Goldwater and the Unmaking of the American Consensus. I spoke to him in May when Nixonland was first published. Well, Rick Perlstein, welcome to Fresh Air. This book is a great read. It's sort of a fascinating ride through the late 60s and early 70s, sort of seen centered on the career of Richard Nixon. Let's talk a little bit about Nixon's early life. You say that he was a serial collector of resentments. What resentments did he collect growing up?
Well, he was a real loner. According to the early oral histories, he wouldn't ride on the school bus because he thought the other kids smelled. He was very lonely. He spent all his time up in his father's. His father had a grocery store in a former church, and he would go up into the bell tower and read and read and read and read and read. By the time he made it to college, he was working three times harder than everyone else. He was very smart, and he received a scholarship to Harvard. And he never went to Harvard. He never went to Harvard because his family basically couldn't afford the train ticket from Whittier. They couldn't afford to send him there from Whittier, California, the small Quaker town in Southern California where he grew up. So he went to this local school, Whittier, which was a fine school, but, you know, was not Harvard, which he bore anger and resentment towards the rest of his life. I mean, you can hear him raging about it on the Nixon tapes. And when he got to Whittier, the first thing he did as kind of young man on the make was try to join the school's one fraternity, which were called the Franklins. And they wouldn't let him in. He was too uncool. So he started his own fraternity. His own fraternity was called the Orthogonians, which he said meant upright or upstanding. And basically, he created a fraternity for the uncool kids. And this turns out to be a brilliant way to charter his political career. Soon he was the student body president. And the secret of his success was that the uncool people in society outnumber the cool people. And someone who speaks to their resentments at being looked down upon could reap a harvest of popularity, which is what he did all through his career and every step of the way. He later would call that group of people the silent majority.
Let's move forward a bit. Your book really focuses on the years, I guess, in between like 1966 and 1972. And you note that you describe 1964, which was the year that Goldwater, of course, lost in a landslide election to Lyndon Johnson, as a liberal apotheosis, an apparent national liberal consensus. Explain what you mean.
Yeah, that was what the pundits said at the time. Lyndon Johnson won with about 61% of the vote. And when Lyndon Johnson was nominated, he basically had a 2-to-1 majority of progressives or liberals in the Senate, and they passed Senate and the House of Representatives, and they passed, you know, the great social legislation that we're still, you know, enjoying, I would say, today: Medicare, Medicaid, the NEA, the NEH, the first environmental legislation, legal aid, of course, and the culmination of that, the absolute apotheosis of the apotheosis, was the Voting Rights Act.
So there was a sense of tolerance and consensus in the land. Now, we go to 1968, and things are very different. I mean, America is roiling with cultural trends which are disturbing to a lot of people. And you know, you describe a point before the New Hampshire primary of 1968, and this struck me as sort of, again, just an example of what some of the roiling social conflicts that were going on. You'd had the Newark riots the year before, 30-some-odd people killed. A report came out on urban riots, the Kerner Commission, in February. On February 17th, the Black Panthers gather to celebrate Huey Newton's birthday, and one of them, James Forman, advocates killing police, sheriffs, and southern governors. That's widely reported. At a police chief's convention, they were displaying armored personnel carriers to deal with civil unrest. And into that climate, we have Richard Nixon staging his comeback. Tell us how he exploited some of that atmosphere, those fears and anxieties, in maneuvering his way to the presidency?
Well, at first he didn't, and that certainly baffled me at first. I mean, the tail end of the story about the signing of the Voting Rights Act was 5 days later were the Watts riots, you know, and they were seen live on TV because KTLA, the television station in Los Angeles, was the first station to have a news helicopter. And in 1966, Lyndon Johnson proposed what was supposed to be the third triumphant apotheosis-like civil rights bill. And this was a civil rights bill that had as its centerpiece an open housing amendment, that an open housing title that would make it illegal to say, I'm not going to rent my house to someone because they're the wrong race. And that year, it went up in flames. I mean, it basically the whole notion that we had this kind of tolerant nation that was passing more and more civil rights legislation just went up in smoke. And the reason it probably went up in smoke was because of all the riots that broke out in city after city, in Cleveland, in Chicago, and even places like Des Moines. Richard Nixon was very busy in 1966. It really was the pivotal year of his comeback. He campaigned for tons and tons and tons of congressional candidates. He worked his tail off. And so he campaigned in city after city after city, and he never mentioned this stuff. He never mentioned the backlash. People like Ronald Reagan and people like George Wallace, the respectively governors, gubernatorial candidate for California governor and the governor of Alabama would mention it all the time. And Nixon didn't mention it, I think, because he knew he had to reestablish his reputation as a statesman and not a gutter snipe. But by 1968, when you get things like the Kerner Commission report, he kind of pivots and he goes all in. And that's when he starts giving speeches about how we have to crush these insurrections by any means necessary, and really kind of casts himself as kind of the field general in the culture war.
Yeah, now he was facing some tough Republican opposition for the Republican presidential nomination. John Lindsay, the former mayor of New York, George Romney, father of Mitt Romney, who George Romney was the governor of Michigan. How did he use these fears and resentments to make himself a different kind of politician, to advance his political interest?
He had this gift for seeing the angers and the resentments that kind of roiled slightly beneath the surface. In that 1966 congressional election where he worked so hard, the Republicans picked up 47 seats. I mean, basically everyone who won on Lyndon Johnson's coattails in 1964 lost in 1966. I mean, basically we had 2 years of this heroically liberal Congress.
You know, by 1968, Nixon has taken a different tack, right, and has decided that there's a different way to elect Republicans.
Yeah. And the way he does it is he runs a commercial hour after hour after hour. You couldn't turn on the TV in the fall of 1968 without seeing Richard Nixon's commercial bearing the slogan, "The first civil right of every American is to be free from domestic violence." So he basically turns the civil rights argument on its head and said the people who were suffering deficits in civil rights were actually white middle-class Americans.
It's interesting. You note that the California primary of 1968 is remembered for Robert Kennedy's win on the Democratic side and then, of course, his assassination that very night. But forgotten, you say, is something that Nixon saw in the results of that primary, which was a sign to him that the shape of the American electorate was shifting. Describe that, will you?
There was a fellow by the name of Max Rafferty. I can't imagine a more obscure name in the annals of recent American politics. He was the education commissioner in California, and he had basically won office in 1962, railing against things like swear words in dictionaries in school libraries, you know, railing against progressive education, railing against even this teaching of evolution in schools. And he ran for Senate in 1968 against an enormously popular liberal Republican by the name of Tom Kuchel, who was the Senate whip. And no one imagined that California would turn out such a powerful senator who basically brought home so much bacon to California. And on the same day that Robert F. Kennedy won the California primary, Max Rafferty won the Republican primary. And in fact, he was on a glide path to winning a Senate seat. This guy who was very extreme, very conservative. And the only reason he was kept from winning was a newspaper reporter discovered a week or two before the election that he had dodged the draft during World War II.
But that was the general election, right? In the primary, he won.
The general election. He won resoundingly and absolutely stunned the pundits. Of course, the pundits were serially stunned. They were stunned over and over again by these conservative, by these conservative groundswells that they never saw coming.
So at a time when a lot of people looked at California and saw a nation embracing the return of a Kennedy and a liberal political philosophy, Nixon saw the beginning of a national realignment, right? I mean, is this when he embraced the Southern strategy? Yeah.
Yes, and political observers should have noticed it much earlier, because on Election Day in 1964, when Lyndon Johnson won California by a million votes, and this was seen as this kind of national consensus for civil rights, on that same day there was an initiative on the ballot against an open housing law, and that also won by a million votes.
We're speaking with Rick Perlstein. His new book is Nixonland, The Rise of a President and the Fracturing of America. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, our guest is Rick Perlstein. His new book is Nixonland, The Rise of a President and the Fracturing of America. You tell a fascinating story here of how Nixon connected with his media consultant, Roger Ailes. How did they meet?
Roger Ailes was the producer, a very young producer, by the way. One of the ironies of the 60s was young people were seen as these kind of avatars of the left and the counterculture. But actually, Roger Ailes was younger than Tom Hayden. He was younger than Abbie Hoffman. And he was the producer of a local show in your own town of Philadelphia called The Mike Douglas Show. And he was a young whiz kid producer. And they had on, in this pivotal year, as I say, for Nixon's career, 1966, Richard Nixon in the makeup chair getting ready to go on the Mike Douglas show. And Nixon is making small talk with this kid and saying, oh, you know, isn't it ridiculous, you know, that the things you have to do to get elected president these days. Go on, you know, a midday show that watched by housewives. And Roger Ailes fixed him in the eye and said, if you think that this is silly, you're never going to become president. And Nixon immediately sent him to New York and ended up hiring him as his media consultant for the 1968 election, where he invented something that's still with us today, the kind of ersatz town hall meeting, in which basically a supposed cross-section of Americans grilled the candidate before a carefully selected audience friendly to the candidate. And that let Roger Ailes cut these things into these TV commercials that made Nixon look enormously smart, charming, heroic, all the rest.
So it was an entirely staged event, but it looked like he was being spontaneous and taking citizens as they come. And one of the fascinating things that you reveal here is that they would often bring somebody in who was too hard-edged, too openly racist, too brazenly conservative. The point being what?
Right. So there's a story. They're having one of these shows, and they're always done locally so that he could kind of spin local issues in local ways, right? And one of the people they had chosen for the panel turned out to be a psychiatrist. And Richard Nixon had earlier told Len Garment that he would do anything to be president except see a shrink. So Len Garment realizes he has this irrational hatred or fear or whatever of psychiatrists. He's like, we got to get the shrink off the panel. But it's the last minute, and they don't know what to do. They have to fill someone in the panel. And Roger Ailes, in this absolutely astonishing quote in Selling of the President, which, you know, I'm not sure people have paid a lot of attention to, says, well, let's get a George Wallace supporter, a cab driver. And Roger Ailes said he can say, all right, Mac, what are you going to do about the, and then he used a racial slur, that begins with N. You know, Roger Ailes recounting how they should get a cab driver. And the whole point of that was then Richard Nixon could come back and deplore that awful language, deplore the sentiments, but basically endorse the same kind of backlash politics that George Wallace was promoting, just in more polite language.
He could be anti-busing, but in a more reasoned way.
Sure, he could do it in four-syllable words and not say things like George Wallace, who said that we don't have riots in Alabama, we just shoot them in the head.
You know, one of the most memorable phrases from this period comes from Vice President Spiro Agnew, who was vice president under Nixon, and he referred to the media, the press then, as the nattering nabobs of negativism. Now, I think this comes from the congressional elections of 1970, I believe, when he and Nixon stumped all the way around the country for conservative senators and congressmen. Give us an idea of their approach, the rhetoric they used, and its impact.
Well, this is 1970, when the most transfixing event of the year happened in May, when four students were shot at Kent State in Ohio. Actually, 13 students were shot, but four died. And afterwards, these insurrections broke out on almost 1,000 college campuses. It was absolutely astonishing. And really, it seemed like America was on the verge of open violence, almost in the streets. And this was the year that Richard Nixon thought he could finally win a majority in the Senate. And he could finally kind of have his will in foreign policy by taking advantage of this social discord in order to campaign for conservative candidates. His point man in this actually was his vice president, Spiro Agnew. And he gave this absolutely scathing series of speeches. Now, lo and behold, it didn't succeed. For whatever reason, and it's a complicated set of circumstances involving economics, certainly involving the Democrats co-opting some of that law and order rhetoric, the Republicans did terribly that year. And a lot of people make the argument that that was the trauma that finally brought Nixon to the brink of Watergate, that he couldn't stand this loss of control, that kind of democracy hadn't worked for him almost, and he was going to try other means.
Do you think, I mean, even though it was a failed electoral strategy, do you think that the impact on political discourse was significant?
Yes. What he did was he had kind of reverted to the rhetoric, he and Spiro Agnew, I should say, reverted to the rhetoric of a George Wallace in 1968. He had forgotten his lesson that you have to present yourself in a time of tumult as someone who was an antidote to the tumult. But he just looked like that year, and he made the Republicans look that year just like another part of the roiling Civil War. He didn't appear to be above the divisions. He didn't appear to be transcendent, and he was punished at the polls.
When Nixon ran for re-election in 1972, there were a number of Democratic candidates, and the strongest contender was Edmund Muskie, who veterans of the time will remember was the senator from Maine who had been the vice presidential candidate for the Democrats in 68, a strong centrist candidate. And Nixon clearly did not want to run against him. He preferred to run against George McGovern, the liberal from South Dakota. And he undertook to make sure that Muskie would not be the nominee. What did Nixon do to ensure that Muskie wouldn't be the Democratic nominee?
He cheated. And the most sort of fragrant tactics were basically ones that were meant to sabotage the campaigns of every Democratic candidate who he thought that he couldn't beat in November, so that he would be running against the one he thought he could beat, who was the anti-war. Well, they were all anti-war candidates. Basically, everyone, even Scoop Jackson, was saying we needed to get out of Vietnam. But he wanted to run against George McGovern because he seemed like the furthest left viable candidate. And so he would do things, or more accurately, his deputies would do things like stealing Muskie stationery, writing a nasty letter about how some other candidate had fathered a child out of wedlock, sending it out to the media, and making it look like the Muskie team was spreading smears about some other candidate. And then he would take another candidate's stationery, say Hubert Humphreys, and do the same thing. They had a word for it that basically you can't say in a family radio station, but it worked. Edmund Muskie eventually withdrew from the race because he was so mercilessly harassed by a letter to a New Hampshire newspaper that turned out to have been written by the White House. It was called the Canuck Letter. back, you know, later when they, you know, was investigated and the Washington Post exposed that it had been written by the White House. The Connect letter basically was a letter to the editor saying, I, down in Florida, heard Edmund Muskie call French Canadians Canucks, which was basically the N-word for French Canadians in Hampshire, who were an important part of the electorate there. And, you know, it was all made up. It was written by a White House aide. And it so incensed Edmund Muskie that he gave this passionate speech to defend himself right in front of the newspaper. And he either did or didn't cry during that speech. Some people think it might have been just a snowflake in his eye or something like that. And when that got out, and when people like David Broder put it all over the papers that this guy had cried on the stump, he was done for. Basically, these false flag operations, as they call it in the intelligence world, achieved their purpose. Hubert Humphrey thought that Edmund Muskie was sabotaging him, and Edmund Muskie thought Hubert Humphrey was sabotaging him, and no one knew that it was Richard Nixon's little underlings who were pulling the strings.
Well, Rick Perlstein, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much, Dave.
Rick Perlstein's book is Nixonland, The Rise of a President and the Fracturing of America. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Delacorte Press, publisher of Fractured, a police procedural thriller set in the heart of Atlanta by Karen Slaughter, author of Beyond Reach. From the Music Performance Fund, striving to enrich lives by sponsoring thousands of public concerts in the United States. Schedules at musicpf.org. And from Barnes & Noble, presenting daily book reviews, author interviews, and more in the Barnes & Noble Review. Online at bn.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the Chicago 8 conspiracy trial and the Democratic convention that took place 40 years ago. We talk with documentary film director Brett Morgan. And John Powers remembers film critic and artist Manny Farber, who died Monday at the age of 91. John says he was one of those critics who opened other critics' eyes. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. One of the most memorable political conventions in American history was the 1968 Democratic Convention in Chicago. The week was marked by bloody clashes between demonstrators and Chicago police, prompting Walter Cronkite at one point to declare the city of Mayor Richard Daley a police state. After the convention, prosecutors charged 8 leaders of the anti-war movement with conspiracy to incite riot, leading to one of the most memorable and chaotic trials of the era. Earlier this year, Terry spoke with documentary filmmaker Brett Morgan, whose film Chicago 10 uses archival footage and recreates the trial through animation, using the voices of such actors as Roy Scheider, Mark Ruffalo, Liev Schreiber, and Hank Azaria. The movie comes out on DVD next week. Before we hear Terry's interview with Brett Morgan, we're going to hear an example of the fascinating archival tape he included in the film. It's a montage from a 1968 meeting of the protest's organizers. You'll hear the voices of Tom Hayden, Abby Hoffman, Rennie Davis, and Ed Sanders.
We have to establish a network for discussion and preparation that takes into account the possibility that you might want, at the time of the convention, a very great outpouring of protest, or the other possibility that you might want protests to occur on a more moderate scale at the convention and in other parts of the country.
We believe that politics is the way you live your life, not who you support. It's not in terms of rallies or speeches or political programs. It's in terms of images and in terms of transforming people's lives.
We are coming to Chicago at the time of the Democratic National Convention, not to disrupt the convention, not to confront the police, National Guard troops, or men in the United States Army, but to challenge the policies of militarization that have been felt so strongly and brutally in Vietnam.
We're going to invest our time, our semen, our love vectors, our intellect in America, and we're not going to allow our country to become one of the fabled damned of nations, to join the Mayan ruins and all the other violent civilizations that have been snuffed.
Brett Morgan, welcome to Fresh Air. People know of the Chicago 7 trial. Your movie is called Chicago 10. Why have you called it that?
Well, you know, it was originally the trial of the Chicago 8, and a few months into the case, Bobby Seale was severed, and it became then known as the Chicago 7. But I came across a quote from Jerry Rubin at some point in which he said, "Anyone who calls us the Chicago 7 is a racist because you're not acknowledging the presence of Bobby Seale. So call us the Chicago 8, but really you should call us the Chicago 10, because our two attorneys, Lem Weinglass and Bill Kunstler, went down with us."
And they were sentenced to contempt.
They were. Kunstler was sentenced to 4.5 years of contempt. I think Weinglass got 1.5. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, the movie is really about appropriating this time period and rendering it as something new. So we decided to rebrand it as the Chicago 10.
Now, before we talk more about how you've made your movie, let's just talk a little bit more about the event itself for anybody who doesn't remember it well or wasn't alive at the time. The demonstration in Lincoln Park at the time of the 1968 Democratic National Convention, it was more than just a demonstration. Abby Hoffman, one of the organizers, described it as total theater, a festival of life. Just talk a little bit about what the intentions were of the organizers.
Well, this was one of the problems with the conspiracy trial in which the government tried to suggest that there was sort of a singular motivation behind the movement. There were a number of different groups that wanted to protest in Chicago. Basically, as early as March of 68, these various organizations approached the city for permits, and Daley, from the get-go, refused to give anyone permits to protest. I think his feeling was he was using the convention as a way to showcase the city. He had spent a great deal of time and money sort of in these beautification efforts. And I think in his mind, the protesters would sort of pollute and dirty that image. And sometime during this process, I think it was in April, after Dr. King was assassinated and they had the riots, Mayor Daley gave the famous shoot to kill order. In which he basically told the assembled media that he was ordering the police to shoot and kill anyone who was involved in any larceny or rioting. And that was kind of an effort to scare the protesters from coming to Chicago. And in fact, it did. But ultimately, there were two main groups that we focus on in the film, the Yippies and the Mobilization. The Mobilization, which was fronted by Rennie Davis, Tom Hayden, and David Dellinger, wanted to do more of a traditional protest in the parks of Chicago. The Yippies, on the other hand, wanted to create a festival of life, as they put it, a celebration of life in the shadows of the convention of death. And what they had envisioned was a three-day sort of Woodstock festival, if you will, with bands like the Rolling Stones and the Beatles and a sort of merging of the hippie countercultural movement with the new left.
Well, the police confronted the demonstrators in the park, they charge them, they tear gas them, they beat them. And tell us what the charges were at the Chicago 7 trial.
Right. So
Chicago
after
8.
the riots in Chicago, we can't even really call them riots because I think the proper terminology is they were police riots. It was really the police going berserk. And for 5 days, they senselessly attacked the demonstrators in a manner that was as vicious as, in my mind, the Rodney King beatings, just on a massive scale. So 3 months after the convention, Nixon won office, and one of the first things that John Mitchell did was indict the leaders of the anti-war movement for conspiracy with crossing state lines with the intent to start a riot. This was, ironically, a new law that was part of the Civil Rights Act. The Chicago 8 are the only people who've ever been tried under the Civil Rights Act and were the first people ever tried it and the only people ever tried under it.
Brett Morgan's film about the conspiracy trial of protesters at the 1968 Democratic Convention is called Chicago 10. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're listening to Terry's interview earlier this year with documentary filmmaker Brett Morgan. His film about the trial of protesters after the 1968 Democratic Convention, called Chicago 10, is out on DVD next week.
Well, this is really going to be interesting. We're going to play an excerpt of your movie with actors portraying the people at the Chicago 8 trial, and then we're going to hear the tape from the actual trial. So let's start with the excerpt of your movie. And again, this is an animated excerpt. And this is the day of the National Vietnam Moratorium. So right before Judge Hoffman enters the court, Dave Dellinger, who's a pacifist and was a leader of an anti-war group, gets up to, and he's one of the defendants, he gets up to address the people in the court before the judge enters. And he explains that the moratorium is a day to protest the continuation of the war and to urge the withdrawal of U.S. forces in Vietnam. And he says that in observance of the moratorium, and to kind of get the sense of the people who are dying senselessly in the war, he's going to read the names of the people who have died in the war this week. So he starts reading the names, and at this point, the court is called to order. Judge Hoffman comes in, and then the prosecutor objects to Dellinger's little speech, and then Kunstler, the defense attorney, objects to the prosecutor. We're going to pick it up as Judge Hoffman has walked in and Dave Dellinger wants to continue speaking.
Mr. Hoffman, we are observing the moratorium.
I am Judge Hoffman, sir.
I believe in equality, sir. So I prefer to call people Mr. or by their first names.
You will sit down, sir.
Can I be heard,
Your Honor? I object to this man speaking out in court.
We would like to propose a moment of silence.
You needn't object. I forbid him to disrupt the proceedings.
Your Honor, I want to object to Mr. Ferrand's yelling in the presence of the jury. Your Honor has admonished...
Your Honor, this is outrageous. This man is a mouthpiece. Look at him. He's wearing an armband of his clients. The government protests his attitude and requests the court move to take notice of his conduct.
Your Honor, I think that the temper and the expression on Mr. Ferrand's face speaks more than any picture could tell.
Of my contempt for Mr. Kunstler.
Mr. Kunstler.
To call me a mouthpiece and for your honor not to open his mouth and say that's not to be done in your court, I think violates the sanctity of this court. That is a word your honor knows is contemptuous and contumacious.
Don't tell me what I know.
I want him admonished, Your Honor, and I request you to do that.
I do not admonish the United States attorney because he was properly representing his client, the United States of America.
To call another attorney a mouthpiece.
You, a lawyer, permitting your client to stand up in the presence of the jury and disrupt these proceedings. I don't know how to characterize it.
Your Honor, we do not permit or not permit our clients. They are free, independent human beings who have been brought by the government
this
courtroom.
They're free, but they'll conform to the law, and they'll conform to the direction of the court here, sir.
Are you turning down my request?
I not only turn it down, I ignore it.
That speaks louder than words.
That's an excerpt of the new film, The Chicago 10, made by my guest, Brett Morgan. And we heard Roar Scheider as Judge Hoffman. Who else did we hear in that scene, Brett?
That was Nick Nolte as Prosecutor Thomas Foran, Dylan Baker as David Dellinger, and Liev Schreiber as Bill Kunstler.
Now, we're going to hear an excerpt of the actual trial, a real audio recording made at the trial that you've brought with you. And before we hear it, is there anything in particular you'd like us to listen for?
The judge's voice, I mean, two things to listen to. Thomas Foran.
The prosecutor.
The prosecutor and the way that he is just absolutely exploding in the courtroom and the inflection of Judge Hoffman's voice is a very unique characteristic that Roy spent a lot of time trying to mimic.
Okay, so we're going to pick up this part of the real tape with the prosecutor objecting to Dave Dellinger's speaking about the Vietnam moratorium.
Your Honor, I object to this man speaking.
You needn't object. I forbid him to disrupt the proceeding. I note for the record that his name is
David Dellinger.
You needn't fill out my sentences for me, sir. I note for the record that the name of this man who has attempted to disrupt the proceedings in this court is David T. Dellinger, and the record will clearly indicate that, Miss Reporter, and I direct him and all the others not to repeat such occurrence.
Your Honor, I just want to object to Mr. Foran yelling in the presence of the jury. Your Honor has admonished many counsel many times on the defense side for yelling, but particularly when the jury was halfway out the door.
I never used the word yelling.
Raising your voice.
If a lawyer representing his client didn't protest that sort of thing, he'd be a mighty poor lawyer for his client.
But not in the presence of that jury, which was deliberately done, Your Honor, as that door was
open. Your Honor, that is outrageous. This man is a monkey. Look at his words, a man like a client. Your Honor, any lawyer who comes into a courtroom and has no respect for the court and acts in conjunction with that kind of conduct before the court, Your Honor, the government protests this attitude and would like the site to move the court to make note of this conduct before this court.
Note has been duly made on the record.
Your Honor, I think that the temper and the tone of voice and the expression on Mr. Foran's face speaks more than any picture could tell.
Mr.
Counselor,
to call me a mouthpiece. And Your Honor, not to open his mouth and say that's not to be done in your court, I think violates the sanctity of this court. That is a word that Your Honor knows is contemptuous and contumacious.
Don't tell me what I know.
Well, then you tell me, Your Honor.
And
you have heard that word used in your court before.
Here, Mr.
And wearing an armband in memoriam to dead, Your Honor, is no disgrace in this country.
That's an excerpt of the actual Chicago 8 trial, a real audio tape of the trial, and my guest Brett Morgan has just made a movie about the trial. Brett, watching the movie, I remember the trial, not that I was there, but I certainly remember coverage of it and how important it was and what a real circus it was. Watching the movie, I was kind of surprised at my reaction because although I think Judge Hoffman was so wrong for this case, he didn't comprehend what was happening at all. He didn't comprehend how or why the people who were on trial were playing him and trying to turn this into political theater. And so all of his reactions were so kind of tone deaf to what was happening and just kind of like feeding the theater as opposed to getting control of the court. But there was a part of me that almost felt for him because, like, what was he supposed to do? Like, everybody was playing him. Everybody was trying to make it into political theater. And you feel him, you know, like, trying to keep control of the court and being clueless about how to do it.
Well, I will tell you that's a credit to Roy Scheider. He found a way to empathize with the judge that came through in the film. And you do get the sense that... you know, the judge has completely lost control. And by the end of the film, even he, you could get the sense that he wishes he was somewhere else. But I will say, Terry, in all fairness, that the defendants didn't march into the courtroom thinking of this as a big piece of theater. I think there was a lot of division amongst the defendants on how to approach the case. But I think Abby and Jerry's reactions to the judge and the fact that they would often speak out in court had a lot to do with the way the judge handled the case in the early days. And he was so biased against the prejudiced against the defendants. I think that Judge Hoffman, who was, you know, in his last days, saw the defendants as a disease that was polluting America. And it was his moral obligation to cut the head off that snake, very similar to Mayor Daley. And in that sense, I always thought of this as a film as much about parenting and generation gap as it was about cultural revolution.
I think, like, the most outrageous moment of the Chicago 8 trial, which you depict in the animated part of your movie, is when Bobby Seale is being spoken of by the prosecutor, and he insists on representing himself, on speaking for himself. His lawyer is sick and isn't there, and he is being charged with things that he says he is innocent of, and he wants to speak out. The judge refuses to let him speak. Seale insists on speaking. So the judge finally does the most outrageous thing a judge can do. He has Bobby Seale bound and gagged and brought back into the courtroom. And this made news around the world. Why don't we hear a scene from your animated recreation of a Bobby Seale chapter of the trial with Jeffrey Wright as Bobby Seale.
I want to request again, demand again, that I be able to cross-examine the witness. Now, you have Benjamin Franklin and George Washington sitting in pictures behind you, and they were slave owners. That's what they were. They owned slaves. And you acted in the same manner by denying me my constitutional right.
Young man. If you
look, old man, you're being exposed to the public and to the world that you don't
want to... Have him sit down, Mr. Marshall.
I want to defend myself. I have the right to speak on behalf of my constitutional rights.
I didn't think I would ever live to sit on a bench in a courtroom where George Washington was assailed by a defendant and a judge was criticized for having his portrait on the wall.
The law protects my right not to be discriminated against. Why don't you recognize that?
Mr. Seale, do you want to stop? Or do you want me to...
You can't deny me my rights. You can't deny me my constitutional rights.
Take that defendant into the room, in there, and deal with him as he should be dealt with.
I still want to be represented. I want to represent myself. Let me go. I want to represent myself. It's my constitutional right. I got a right.
That's Jeffrey Wright as Bobby Seale in one of the animated scenes from, I guess, Brett Morgan's new movie, Chicago 10, which is a movie about the trial and the demonstrations that led to the trial. There were parts of the demonstration where demonstrators, as we were being beaten by the police, shouted, "The whole world is watching." And did you really get that feeling going through all this footage, like the impact that it made for the world to see this?
Well, it's an interesting question, because what the world saw in 1968 is not what the world will see through my film.
What do you mean?
I watched all of the broadcast of the riots, and except for the last one in front of the Conrad Hilton, you know, there was an electrical strike in Chicago that week. So there was very limited video remote feeds going on. And so in general, what the networks would do is they would send one camera down to a riot to cover it. And then 4 hours later, they would air maybe 45 seconds up to 2 minutes of unedited footage from one perspective. So the march to the Conrad Hilton at the end was culled from over 50 visual sources and over 20 audio sources. And so the events that we're depicting them are really not what the world saw in 1968. What's shocking to audiences when I speak with them about the film is that 70% of America at the time supported Mayor Daley. And the only thing I could explain to them is, you know, the America was presented with a specific image of these riots, and it really took 40 years for us to come around and reconstruct them.
Well, Brett Morgan, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Documentary filmmaker Brett Morgan speaking with Terry Gross earlier this year. His film Chicago 10 is out on DVD next week. Coming up, John Powers remembers film critic and artist Manny Farber. This is Fresh Air. Manny Farber died on Monday at age 91. An acclaimed artist, the New York Times declared him the greatest still-life painter of his generation. Farber also wrote about the movies. He did it so well that filmmaker Paul Schrader once said he belonged on the Mount Rushmore of American film criticism. Our critic-at-large John Powers agrees, with a special accent on the word American.
It's always been easy to make fun of critics, even critics at large. Mark Twain described us as eunuchs in the harem, saying, they know how it's done and see it done every day, but they can't do it themselves. Maybe so, but nobody would have ever made such a joke about Manny Farber. Even as his real job was being a gifted painter, a poster of one of his still lifes hangs on my wall, Farber moonlighted as a film critic from the 40s to the early 70s. Now, it's possible that you've never heard of Manny Farber, but in a sense you already know him, for he was one of those critics who opened other critics' eyes. He was admired by everyone from Pauline Kael to Susan Sontag. The one collection of his criticism, called Negative Space, is on every critic's bookshelf, and it's amazing how often it's been quoted, borrowed from, strip-mined, or used as a launching pad. Although he knew his high art, Farber grasped that motion pictures shouldn't be looked at in the same way as old-world masterpieces like the Mona Lisa or Madame Bovary. The movies are all about looseness and movement, the boundless unruliness of life. Farber disapproved of filmmakers who tried to impose too much highfalutin order on things. This included everyone from John Huston to Michelangelo Antonioni. At the same time, he was among the first to champion Howard Hawks and that two-fisted pulpmeister Sam Fuller. For Farber, what makes movies great is the same thing that made jazz America's enduring contribution to 20th century music. The swing, the personal virtuosity, the knockabout ease that is a democratic culture's answer to aristocratic savoir-faire. He was perhaps the first to see that the true glory of American movies lies not in high-minded message pictures like To Kill a Mockingbird or Schindler's List, but in B-movies and genre pictures like The Big Sleep, where the artistry is hidden within playfulness. Take, for instance, this scene from The Big Sleep, where Humphrey Bogart's Philip Marlowe is in the bedroom of his client's daughter, played by Lauren Bacall.
And I don't like your manners.
Well, I'm not crazy about yours. I didn't ask to see you. I don't mind if you don't like my manners. I don't like them myself. They're pretty bad. I grieve over them long winter evenings, and I don't mind you ritzing me or drinking your lunch out of a bottle. But don't waste your time trying to cross-examine me.
People don't talk to me like that.
Oh.
Do you always think you can handle people like trained seals?
Uh-huh. I usually get away with it, too.
How nice for you.
If anything in Farber's work is well known, it's his distinction between so-called white elephant art and what he dubbed termite art. While the former announces its capital I importance, it has the bloated pretension we now associate with Oscar bait, termite art goes forward by energetically nibbling away at boundaries. It's the difference between Robert De Niro gaining 70 pounds to star in Raging Bull and that 6-foot-5-inch termite John Wayne dominating a scene with the casual confidence with which he moves across the screen. Unlike many critics, Farber was never a systematizer or thumbs-up, thumbs-down kind of guy. He simply wrote what he saw and felt, presenting his thoughts the way Charlie Parker sprayed his notes. His passages come at you in waves that dazzle on the page, but are hard to read out loud, because no sentence or two can do him justice. His writing could be so sharp and funny that, even today, young critics foolishly try to imitate him. But this misses the whole point. You're supposed to have your own personality, not his. Such an emphasis on the personal is part of what made Farber so distinctively American. And not just American, but of the American West. Born in Arizona, he wound up in San Diego, and his career is a triumph of Wild West individualism in all its thorny unpredictability. Politically, he was conservative. He twice voted for President Bush. But aesthetically, he was far from it. He was as happy to champion Godard and Fassbinder as he was in praising William Powell and Ida Lupino. For him, the highest value was freedom. The freedom of actors to capture fleeting moments without being crushed by some director's preening visual scheme or by $50 million worth of CGI. The freedom of filmmakers to capture life in all its rude outrageousness without feeling the need to ennoble the audience with big statements. And the freedom of critics to offer their personal response to work without worrying about some artistic hierarchy inherited from Europe or being forced to serve as a consumer guide. Put simply, Manny Farber was the critic as libertarian, and he left American culture a little bit freer.
John Powers writes about film for Vogue. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Fred Snyder. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. Our digital production project supervisor is Julian Hertzfeld. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Support for NPR comes from Delacorte Press, publisher of Fractured, a police procedural thriller set in the heart of Atlanta by Karen Slaughter, author of Beyond Reach. From the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age. And from Barnes & Noble, presenting daily book reviews, author interviews, and more in the Barnes & Noble Review, online at bn.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Both the McCain and Obama campaigns are courting the religious vote. On the next Fresh Air, we look at how they're doing with journalist Dan Gilgoff, politics editor for BeliefNet.com and former political correspondent at U.S. News & World Report. His blog, The Godometer, measures the rate of God talk among the candidates. Join us for the next Fresh Air.